This is Sons of the Flag Radio, brought to you by Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Before we begin tonight's show, we always like to take a moment to honor and recognize those that we've lost since our last show. Tonight we honor Dwayne Hudson, Michael Watkins, Brad Gregorich, Cody Van Fossen, Barry Bolton Sr., William Frank, Mitchell Lundgaard. May we take a moment of silence for these guys. Tonight's episode is part two of our three-part series with our Guns for Sons sweepstakes recipient, Andy Allison. Andy, now medically retired from the Louisville Fire Department, was injured in a house fire on August 12, 2012. As Andy was extinguishing a small fire in the laundry room, Andy came into contact with electricity and was electrocuted during the operation. After more than 2 years of doctor's visits, surgeries, and seeking answers about his injuries, at the age of 31, Andy was told that he would not be able to return to the career he loved and called his dream job. Joining us tonight will be Andy Allison and his wife, Amanda Allison. If you are feeling compelled by tonight's story, you can help Sons of the Flag support firefighters like Andy by taking the St. Florian vow. You can text the word JOIN to 682-204-1729 to begin the fundraising process today. Another way you can take the vow is by emailing Chad Groover at chad@sonsoftheflag.org. In the last episode, we left off with Andy, Amanda, and Chief McGrath discussing the full extent of Andy's injuries and the damaging effects in which they are secretly having on Andy's body. With that comes the realization of not being able to continue on with the job of his dreams and the impending battle of and complications with workman's comp. Now I turn this interview over to our National Task Force Director, Chad Groover.
Andy, you just got home from the surgery. The results were not what you and Amanda had expected. The doctors were not expecting it as well. They had thought that your spine was going to be at a 30-degree angle. They find out that it's a lot worse. It's at 40 degrees. You're supposed to be paralyzed. You're not supposed to be able to walk. You get home. How do you begin to process this information? What is running through your mind?
Well, first off, I think just arriving there, it was an awesome feeling to be home. I was glad to be out of the hospital. I think one thing that I learned going into that surgery is sometimes, although overcomers, like I like to think of myself as somebody that just wakes up and puts my shoes on every morning and goes, when you're faced with that kind of challenge, you know, my goal was to get home as quick as possible. Like, I want to get the surgery and I want to get back to normal living. Well, you know, I had a really good doctor that did this surgery, very helpful for Amanda, very compassionate with her, very understanding for us, young doctor that did the surgery. And, you know, he's the one that talked me into going to the rehab. I didn't want to do the rehab. I just wanted to go back to my house. That's where I feel comfortable. My wife's there, my kid's there. That's where I need to be. And so it was kind of a surreal feeling actually getting to come home.
How long were you in rehab?
So I was at Medical Center of Plano for almost 2 weeks, or 7 days.
Yeah, maybe. 7 to 10 days.
And then I was at Select Rehab. It's a rehabilitation, but they do a lot of strokes. So, I mean, it's like me, and then, you know, the closest person in age is like 60 or 70. So it was a pretty wild scenario for me. I was there for 14 days. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're talking 3 weeks, and not only have you changed a little bit of my body position out of the surgery, you've also given me, the doctor's given me almost 2 inches of height back. So imagine going and laying down and then waking up, and the first couple times you stand up, the first time you walk into your house, not only are you not hunched over, but you're 2 inches taller. So I bought this house. Amanda made me move to the city of Argyle, which is a town, but it's a city.
We live in like a rural community. one side of the highway is just like hundreds of cattle and cows. We do not live in the city by any means, but it is much more than he ever.
I noticed he was real quick to throw you under the bus there. Amanda made me move.
Let me just tell you, I can touch my neighbor's house from my house. Like there is, I don't know, there's less lot lines than mine, but mine feels like zero. They're on top of me, is what I'm saying, over in this city I live in.
Okay.
Okay. So she moves me to the city. And lets me pick the house. Mm-hmm. You know, we go, we pick this house together. You know, first walking in, I'm so glad to be home. But everything's so different, right? Getting in and out of the car is different. I'm in tremendous pain. I can't move, really. So, you know, I'm creeping in with, I have a walker, you know? I mean, that's just real attractive. Half my teeth at this point. So I'm just looking fresh getting home, right?
Did she at least give you the tennis balls on one side of the walker?
She did, to help me get across that concrete, probably because she didn't want me to fall and lose any more teeth, because I was already looking pretty scraggly in this scenario. So here I come, get in the front door. First thing I do is catch the ceiling fan, like, right in my forehead. And I'm immediately just infuriated. And I, you know, I turn around in this thing, like, 1 mile an hour, you know, like the, you know, Austin Powers turn around. Getting this thing whipped around, and I look at her and I'm like, who bought this house? And she's like, you did. And I'm like, dang it, that 3 inches, 2.5 inches they gave me back. You know, in my old house, we had these big 14 foot ceilings. So that's like the first impression I get home, is that I've bought a house that I don't fit in. And now I've lived here for a little while. So this is like, this is a big deal, Gruber. I mean, this is intense. So anyways, you know, the doctor tells me, okay, so our house is based, like, you know, all the living quarters are upstairs and the kitchen, and, you know, we have a dining room and stuff downstairs. So the doctor tells her he can go up or down one time a day. That's it. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you can go down the stairs once and up the stairs once. No more than that. So you are planted where you're at for like 12 weeks. And I'm like, yikes. Well, that's tough, you know. I mean, it's tough on family dynamics because, you know, we have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda is trying to figure out. She's finishing her degree. Had you just finished?
I just graduated.
She just graduated. So she's trying to figure out what she's going to do for a career. But now she's got this husband that can't lift the kid. And he can only go up and downstairs once. So we're trying to reorganize our house, put refrigerators upstairs and stuff, and make this like livable for me to stay on one floor. And that was pretty intense. It was hard for me because I want to get outside every day. But if I go outside, then I can't get back to my bed.
That's right? Your one time.
That's my one time. So that was tough. So we, and then I had a big vitamin deficiency. So I really did. I used to make fun of my Chief McGrath, and I, we used to battle back and forth because at that time I was not working, obviously, but I was getting a check in the mail, you know, from the city. They would just send my check. So he would ask me what I was doing on Fridays, and I'd always tell him, oh, well, I'm sitting out here suntanning with my can of Busch Light waiting for the mailman to arrive for my check to come in the mail. You know, it was just a joke back and forth, and I'm laid out front. I used to literally have to lay out in the sun to get this vitamins in me because I look like a ghost. And, you know, originally I'm 6'8", like 200 pounds. When I come in from this surgery, you know, I'm like 6'6", and like a week after I'm at home, I'm at 165 pounds. I mean, 165 pounds, you think, on, you know, somebody under 6 foot or right around 6 foot, okay, that's normal. But somebody that's 6'8", man, I look like a skeleton. I looked sick. My face was sunk in. My family barely could recognize who I was. So it was very surreal getting back home and getting into what I consider the new life, and at least for the next year. I mean, because that's 18 months of recovery. And as soon as I get settled, Amanda and I have the tough conversation of, okay, you know, you can't go back to work. So now everything in my life is different, and I'm also know that I'm not going back. Like, I had to accept that, and I'm accepting that in the process of trying to learn how to walk and get dressed again. And that was tough on me.
And I assume, you know, with any big decision or any major thing that happens in life, you have to go through the stages of grief. You know, you have denial.
Mm-hmm.
We've probably gotten through that part at this
yep.
point. Bargaining. I'll do anything. You've already
yep.
tried to do
yep.
everything.
Tried to do that.
And now we're starting to get to, and anger comes on.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're starting to get to the acceptance point.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that there was a certain part of my inner group that knew at the beginning that this was going to be very hard to overcome. Mentally, physically, when you talk about losing your career, you know, everybody seems to hone in on that. Like, okay, well, you lost your passion and you lost your career. Okay, well, there's a lot more to Andy Allison than the fire service. I love it. I grew up in it. I mean, my dad, I would love to go back and ride a fire truck today. But I also was a human being outside of that. I lost all my hobbies. I lost who I was when I met my wife. And so the grieving process is a lot deeper for me than, hey, you just can't go to work every third day and do that thing, right? So a third of the year, you lose something.
Yeah.
But the other two thirds of the year, you lose everything else.
Yeah, you're starting over.
Starting over. It was a dark time, I think, for me. I think she knew that. I think we had, we kind of put her working on hold because she knew that she needed to be there. I had a home. I'm 30 years old and I have home health. You know, they're coming in every day. PT's coming to my house. I mean, my house has got all these medical devices and things all over it. I mean, and one of the big issues that we ran into that was, for us, very unfortunate is when in the thoracic, when they did this surgery, they aggravated a nerve that went to my stomach. And so part of the reason I lost all this weight so quick is because that my stomach hurt all day, every day. I mean, she couldn't keep any liquids down me. She's trying to force feed me. She's buying Gatorade. We're buying every kind of antacid. I mean, she's frantic, calling the doctor. She's calling her dad, who is a doctor. Her mom's a doctor. I mean, we have a team on this deal. I'm not getting out of bed. I'm not getting out of the couch. I move one time and that's it. And I can't keep anything down. So literally my life is flashing before my eyes because every time that I'm awake enough, it's because I'm in pain. I take another pain medicine and then I go back out pretty much. And in the meantime, she's trying to take care of our baby and trying to make sure that her undergrad's in nutrition. So she's got all these things spinning. Oh my gosh, my husband has lost 40 pounds. I mean, yes, his back hurts and yes, the surgery's crazy, but we have to get him healthy or he won't survive. And, you know, I'll let her talk a little bit about, you know, the other side of that. Cause honestly, I don't remember a lot of those couple of weeks.
Yeah. You're drugged up.
I'm drugged up. I'm gonna be honest with you.
Yeah. Amanda?
Well, I think part of it was the fact that he was on a lot of pain medication, but I also think that mentally at some point there's only so much you can take. And so I've noticed that during that time, that was hard on him. Even his, like, some of our closest friends, they couldn't see him that way. They'd come over to visit him, and it was scary enough that they were uncomfortable. They didn't like it. They hated it for him. They were heartbroken for him. And what that meant for them is that they didn't want to come around until he was healthier, which we get. But here I am. I have this husband who is hurt, stuck in this room for weeks upon time, and he just wants someone to talk to, someone to come over, hang out with him, watch football, get his mind off of it. But what, only a handful of people, and people have full-time jobs. They have families. They have all these other things going on. So I have that going on, trying to figure that out. We had a couple close friends who told us that they couldn't, they loved him. They called him every single day, but they couldn't handle seeing him in person yet right then. And he understood it, and he did really well for that. But that was extremely hard for me to handle, because I could see that what he needed. He's a very, very much a people person. He's used to being at the station with a whole bunch of guys talking about things. He's very social in that aspect. And that was hard. So he not only was losing his job and his hobbies, but then he was kind of shut in this corner for weeks, months. Nice. As he healed with, he got to see his therapist, the PT, and the nurse, who half the time was a different nurse. So every time they came over, we had to go through everything that had been going on. Well, he's lost this much weight. This is what's going on with his stomach. What do we do? Well, I don't know. I wasn't here yesterday. I'll talk to somebody and I'll get back to you tomorrow. Okay. Well, the next day it'd be somebody else. And so we were just weren't getting answers. It got to the point where his doctors had me tracking how much fluid he was taking in. And if he didn't hit a certain mark, then I had to get him to the hospital. Because it was a rough 2 weeks home, those first couple weeks. It was hard. I think in addition to the physical side of it, because I know we kind of talked about, he had to learn how to walk again, put on his clothes. It was a month before he could get himself out of bed without help. It was just a lot of lifestyle changes. I joke now, though, that we could totally write a book about how to prepare for surgery for families, like what to take to the hospital, tips and tricks when you get home, because it's an adjustment. That mini fridge he mentioned that made it upstairs, it's still there. It's now the game room. But that was a lifesaver then. If I did have to go somewhere, especially with our year and a half old, like take him to his own doctor appointments and checkups, I'd have to stock it with like snacks and stuff, and he'd have to get creative with like a grabber, or we'd have someone come over to hang out and sit with him so that I could go do the other things we needed to do.
I've had lots of babysitters in the last 7 years. Seriously.
I can't imagine, because you're stuck in limbo.
Yeah.
And no offense, you're basically a zombie at this point.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you, Amanda, have a 15-month-old baby, correct?
Yes.
You have postponed your career.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't know what it's going to be. You just graduated, all your hard work, and now you're totally shifting gears.
Yep.
How did you do this?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know. We really tried to focus on one day at a time, honestly. For Andy, for me, the biggest thing was making sure he could get through recovery and getting him to a therapist. But when it came for me, we've always been good about sitting down and kind of writing out our goals. So whether it's like financial stuff, making a budget, things like that. I guess it's the planner side of me. That's just what I like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did. We had a big talk when he was retiring of what I was going to do. And so before he got hurt, I was working at Children's in Dallas. Loved it. Then he got injured. We had the baby. And it's kind of hard to get a job that will let you off to help your husband recover for 2 months at a time, or for little surgeries, or to drive him to those doctor's appointments. Once he was allowed out of the house, he had to go to physical therapy 3 days a week, and then he had to see a therapist twice a week, which went down to one eventually. But then he was also seeing a vestibular therapist and doing his checkups.
And he's not able to drive.
He's not able to drive. Yeah, he couldn't drive for 6 months after that surgery.
Yeah, something like that.
And so,
almost that year, because I had the first, all three surgeries were in the year. So it was about a year of not driving when you combined the three.
So it was one of those things where we were looking at, I could go back to work and we could hire someone to come take him to all these things and pay for childcare and I not be there.
But then you're almost not working because all the money's going to
take care of Andy. So that's when we decided to keep our family focused first. And even if that meant we were going to have to downsize a house or do whatever it took to make that happen, that's what our focus was going to be. Get him through the big recovery, and then I would get the chance to look at what my future looked like. So we made that decision, and I don't ever regret it. I think it's awesome. I think that that's why we are where we are now, because going through all of this stuff, I mean, we counted up the other day how many times he had to go to his PTSD sessions. And it's funny because workers' comp will say, well, you've been to the therapist this many times after your surgery. You should be fine now. Like, you're good. It only takes 6 weeks to recover from a surgery. And we'd be like, but this isn't a surgery we're recovering from. This is like a total body, like everything. And so once we got him to a healthier standpoint, then we kind of got to focus more so on me. And that was hard because even now I really struggle with making sure that he's got everything that he needs, just because it took so much away from him already. We don't want him to miss out on anything else. So one of the things that it took away was they told us after our first son that we weren't going to have any more kids, that he had too much stuff going on all across everywhere. And so for our second, we tried for a year and we ended up getting pregnant with number two, little Ruger. He's our firecracker. But they told us they have no idea how that happened. No clue. But we did. It was amazing. And we often tell everyone that our kids are what got us through this because it gave us something to hope about. So we're dreamers. If you've ever gotten a chance to talk to us like one-on-one, like we just love it. Anything it is. We'll dream up new business ideas, like cool fun games. We don't care. You got to have something to look forward to. And so our kids kind of gave us that. We got to talk about like what they're going to be like when they grow up and when baby's coming. And it gave us something positive to focus on in between all the surgeries and doctor appointments and Andy trying to figure out
just your new
who
hope.
He is. Exactly. That's exactly what it was. So Ruger came along, and he's amazing, just like his brother. And then after that, Andy had another back surgery, and they said, we had a couple complications, nothing too crazy, but you guys are done having kids, essentially. And so...
Did y'all want more than two kids?
Yes. We compromised on three. I would have been okay with four. Four or five kiddos. Andy wanted two. So... We always wanted three.
There's a whole theory. Now, you have a lot of, you had how many brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers. There's three of us.
There's three of you. And you came.
Well, there's four. Yeah.
Okay. There is the theory that if the kids outnumber the parents, the kids win.
Oh.
And it's the man.
I don't even know that that's accurate.
That's not a theory. It's the zone defense versus man on man.
If there's any kids, they win most of the time. But yeah, we're outnumbered now, which is nice, I guess.
Okay, Andy. So she talked about the PTSD.
Yeah.
And I'm not
touched on that a little bit.
Do you feel comfortable telling everybody how it actually manifested in you? Because that is a big trend right now in the fire service and people not recognizing PTSD and not being able to say I need help.
And I think for me, you know, when you put a label on something like PTSD and you look up the definition, you start reading a little bit about it, you're like, okay, you know, it's hard for me to put my injury and my stuff in a box and just say, yeah, that's me, right? So I think for people that are going through depression, anxiety, PTSD, you're looking for an answer for how you feel. And a lot of times, those things don't line up with the definition of something. And for me, I was struggling because mentally, I'm happy with my life. Does that make sense? I love my wife. She's been ultimate support. The only reason I'm probably alive right now is because she's been there to get me through it. I love my kid. I love being able to be home. I'm happy to be alive. But on the other side, I have this void that is, who am I? You know, I'm broken pieces. I'm not the same fit, tall and statured, wide shoulder, you know, first responder guy that I've always been, athlete. Now I'm literally, when I look in the mirror, I see a sunken face. I mean, it looked like I was on meth. I'm not kidding you. It looked like I was on some kind of drug that does that to you because I'm missing half my teeth, my face. I'm just a small frame of myself. And so that happened like that, right? It happened so fast. And in that year that I'm like just overcome. What's the next surgery? What do we got to do? What do we have to do to get you through with school? What does our kid need? Okay, let's just do it. Let's get back to work. Let's get these things happening. And then all of a sudden, you know, I turn around and I'm a frail piece of nothing, right? I mean, and I'm just a shell of who I used to be. And so I start looking at myself, and I don't know that moment after that big surgery is when PTSD set in. I started having the first symptom, I think, for my mental struggles actually came at night. To this day, I mean, we're 7 years down the road, and I have, I call them hallucinations. It is a very strange thing. When I lay down, okay, my mind just goes, okay, so I can go all day with, I put all these tasks in front of myself. Okay, I got to go to PT. I need to make sure that, you know, my wife is happy and what she needs. I need to make sure I play with my son. You know, at that time, I need to make sure I hit all these marks. So I do that all day long. I push, push, push. And then everybody goes to sleep and I'm by myself, right? And it's quiet. And now I'm replaying my life and who I am. I'm like, oh my gosh, I just got so hurt. And how am I going to get up tomorrow? And what am I going to do? And it's in that moment that I start drifting off to sleep. And literally, this is why I started going to, I had to go to sleep specialist and to a counselor, because Amanda's waking me up. Literally, I could be talking to her, on laying next to her, talking to her, and I drift off to sleep, and I know I'm going to sleep. And as soon as I do, boom, I wake up in my mind, nothing switches, and she's falling off the bed. Okay. And I mean, this is what I'm picturing. All of a sudden, she wakes me up with me across her after this back surgery. I'm in a contraption. I'm leaned across her trying to grab something off the ground because I think she's falling off the bed. I mean, this is literally like I'm hallucinating going to sleep. And I mean, it gets crazy. I mean, she finds me, you know, trying to leave the house, trying to do all the, like, I'm not even supposed to go down the stairs and I'm sitting on the stairs. I mean, I'm having all these scenarios. So at first, it's like, okay, is this medication? Let's look at that. So we changed all the medications. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, we're 7 years in and I still am having, what they are telling me is they're like vivid flashbacks of stressful times in my life. Maybe not her falling off the bed, but a lot of times it starts with a flash of the back of an ambulance for me. I mean, I don't even remember walking to that ambulance that day, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but I know we have the chevrons on the back. It was our ambulance and the one I got in. I mean, I have that flashback as soon as I drift off into sleep. And so, you know, she's like, it's time for you to go talk to somebody. Well, man, that just opened the door to everything. I go sit down with a lady and I'm like, okay, these are my problems. And she said, okay, whoa, back up. we're a couple years into this injury and you've had all of these things happening. You're sleeping, going to sleep is not the problem. It's processing all of this stuff. You have put aside all of your feelings, all of the, you put on the worker hat as soon as you got in that ambulance on how am I going to beat this, instead of saying, hey, I'm hurt and I need help. And we have to figure out how to get you back to that point to where mentally we can get you healthy. And so it's hard to admit that you're not mentally where you want to be. You know, it's hard for me. It's scary for me. I mean, I feel like I make a joke all the time. Put another screw in me and I'll keep going. Right. I mean, I'm screwed together, but they piece me together and I don't care what it takes. I'm getting up in the morning. They tell me I can't do it. I'm doing it. But the mental side of thing is something that I can't just make myself overcome.
You can't turn that off.
I can't turn it off. And I can't make myself go to sleep. And I can't make myself quit having thoughts of being super emotional and depressed. And she knows. One day I wake up, I'm a very happy person. But it's like a switch for me. And some days I'm very sad. I'm depressed. I want to sit on the couch all day. And I don't know what does it. I don't know what's causing it. I mean, I'm sure it's a combination of everything. But the fight that goes on mentally for me is, I'm sad that my life has changed. but I'm not sad that I'm at home with my family and I love my wife. How do I express to the world that I'm thankful for help and I'm thankful for the position I get to be in and the family that I've received, but also be sad that I'm in this situation? You know what I mean? It's a very, very slippery slope for me.
You're torn.
I'm torn.
It's it's almost a paradox.
I have to tell her on mornings that I'm in a bad, like I wake up and I'm frantic on something. And I tell her, I'm like, I'm not mad at you. Okay. Before we start the day, I love you and I'm not mad at our kids. I am literally, I'm struggling today and I don't want it to come across that I'm mad at you. And that's hard to hear because I'm snappy or whatever, and it may be because the weather's made my legs hurt worse, or who knows the scenario. But I'm not mentally healthy that day, and I can't imagine being on the other side of that and have her tell me that, and then all day be in this weird like paradox of her not being herself but not feeling, like trying to be like, I know you're not mad at me. You're just acting really pissed at me right now. But I know you're not. You know what I mean? Like, how do you figure that out as a family? It is not an easy road.
And not to bring up something bad, you know, you're still not able to pick up your child, correct?
Right. Right.
So your playtime is basically having Amanda put your baby on your lap because you can't hold it.
Mm-hmm. Her job is like triple times of what my job is. I mean, my job at this time is get up and, you know, hopefully be able to put my shoes on. You know, I got a tool and all these things, and I'm trying to get motion back and trying to get healthy and not let go of the grip of, I still want to be the father and the husband, right? Like, I want to provide for her. I want to be the dad that's awesome, that plays with his kid and runs around in the backyard and does those things. Mentally, I tell myself I can do it, but physically, my body won't allow me.
And so even your brain's fighting.
Like, my brain is fighting every day. Like, I want to just get up and pick my son up. And I know I'm 30. My mind's still 30, right? But I look down and everything else is like I'm an old man. And no offense. I mean, I feel like I am super fragile and I'm in a 60-year-old body, and I'm a 30-year-old man, and it happened overnight. Like I said, I wake up and I'm different. So that was just, man, it has been a deep battle for us.
It's been hard. I think the biggest thing when it comes to mental health is it's really easy to say, yeah, but I'm happy with my family. Me and my wife are good. Or yeah, but these people struggle with bigger things and really downplay what you've got going on. And I think that was probably the biggest hurdle that we placed in front of ourselves and Andy put in front of himself, is that, like, yes, all this has happened, but he has a kid and a wife and we're great. So he's okay. He doesn't need to be depressed, or he doesn't need to be struggling with this stuff. But in actuality, like, you are, and that's, it's okay that you are, and you can be happy, but also be working through things. And I think a lot of people don't. It's hard to admit, especially for parents with kids, because you have kids, you're happy, your life is good, but it's okay to have a good life and still need to talk to somebody. I can tell you from my perspective, I watched Andy go from, you know, we talked about it being like extroverted out there, like everybody's friend. He would drop everything to go help someone. And then he got injured and he was in the receiving end of it, and it was very difficult for him to ask for help. A lot of his buddies and friends that did come over and they helped either move us from our house or just do little things that just made a huge difference. They would finally call me and say, you know, I keep asking Andy, what can I do? What can I do? And it's hard to ask for help. Nobody wants to be that person. But especially if you're the guy that usually is the one who's called. Andy always jokes that he gets the phone calls because he has a truck. I think it's because, one, he can fix anything. It's the craziest talent. It's awesome. But he has the biggest heart. He'll drop everything to go help someone. And so for him, asking for that was is not natural. Even now, years later, he doesn't like to ask for help because he knows that there are other people out there that need it more than he does. And I love that about him, but I think that with the whole mental health and PTSD thing, that didn't help him any. When he could have said, yeah, actually, I can't change the oil in my truck. Like, I need someone to help me because my wife's going to take it into the store and then they're going to try to sell her brake pads and all these other things because she doesn't know what she's doing. And that was difficult. And then going through all the rehabs and recovery, like, we would celebrate all the little things, like the fact that he could get himself up and get dressed. That was huge. And that's awesome. But that's not something you go post on your Facebook. Guys, today I got up and I put my own clothes on. It was awesome. Fact. So even though we're celebrating it in the house, that's still something that you don't just show off to the world. So there's a lot of things that people just didn't see because you don't talk about. You don't talk about the fact that it's hard to, he couldn't sit on his couch even. So he'd go into the living room when someone would come to visit and we'd get him all set up and seated and comfortable before they showed up so that when they got there, they weren't made uncomfortable because of how much it hurt him to get in and out of a seat. We'd set him up, he'd be all set, they'd leave, and then we'd get him out of the seat back into bed because it hurt so much. So just little things that he felt like he still needed to do to make other people comfortable while he was pushing back everything he went through is what I saw. And then, of course, struggling with the whole not being the dad he thought he was. And we've had lots of conversations about how even though you want to go do X, Y, Z with them, like, I can see you're hurting. You need to take it easy, take a day off. Otherwise, in 10 years when our kids are playing football in high school, you're not going to be able to play catch with them at all. You're not going to be able to get out of the house. And that's something that his doctors, I think they try to do a really good job at mentally and adequately preparing us for everything. But they constantly, every single one, reminds both of us, like, you're only in your 30s. You have a lot more time to go. You need to take it easy now. Otherwise, you're going to be sitting at your child's high school graduation in a wheelchair. Your daughter's going to get married and someone's going to have to wheel you down the aisle. And he doesn't want that. But that means he can't go play with his kids right now like he would want to, because he has to make choices today that will get him through the next 3 decades. And that's hard. And that's a lot for anyone to kind of put on themselves and think about, let alone someone who likes to go full force, used to ride dirt bikes, firemen. It's difficult. But what I saw when he went to go to a counselor was that, one, if you go to one and you don't like them, it doesn't click, don't go back to them. Find a different one. You get to pick. You get to pick what doctor you go to. Pick the therapist you go to. Find someone you can talk to freely. You can say what's on your mind. You can let it all out. Because I would notice that Andy would start getting angry or feeling worked up and built up, especially with stuff around this time in 2015. We were going through a lot of issues with the workers' comp side of things. And it was very stressful and overbearing. And it would kind of build up and he would get really kind of built in, and I could tell he was trying so hard not to let it out at home and just wanting to vent about things, really. And he'd go to a session and come back, and it was like someone just took a weight off of his shoulders. It was awesome. And what that allowed for him was he could enjoy his day. He could enjoy his kids. He and I could talk more, and it wasn't like everything was negative. And it wasn't that he was being negative towards me. It was that the situation sucked, and it was hard to look past that. But when he had an outlet to go dump it on, that left the opportunity for us to have a relationship still versus it being focused on dumping on everything. So for us, that was a really big turning point. It was a really helpful, I think, outlet and tool. So I don't know. I think focusing on mental health is one of the biggest things that anybody can do, whether you're severely injured or you just got a lot of stuff you want to throw at somebody.
Well, for me, it's the husband, okay? There's a lot on my plate, right? And as I watch my family process my injury, they have processed at their own speed, and my friends. So they see me hurt, but for me to turn around and just go off on a tantrum on how angry I am at the situation or how upset I am that, you know, workers' comp has been difficult. You know, I mean, I'm just going to be honest with y'all. You know, the fire administration wasn't there to help me that much at that point. They didn't come and visit. They didn't. Now, I had certain people at the fire department, some battalion chiefs, but, you know, I didn't see the head guys there. I always thought that that's what happened. Like, you know, you would have those guys by your side.
And we're still in 2015, right?
We're still in 2015. Okay, we haven't even moved past that yet.
And you retired December 31st
of
2015.
Yeah.
And I remember pictures from the ceremony. I had met you.
Yes.
And it was a big deal.
It was huge. Phenomenal. I mean, honestly, it was the most honored I've ever felt. But
in the same sentence, you're saying, you know, they did this huge honor for you, but you don't feel the support.
So I think what he's referring to is we joked in the last episode about how a year plus after, people didn't even know he was hurt. That's a simple email that could have been sent out to let everybody know. Hey, guys, your brother, your fireman who works in your station on a different shift, this is what happened to him. Think about his family. Check in on him. Send him something. And like he mentioned, he has a lot of friends to this day that were there for us then, that were there for us now, that did do that. But, I mean, you know how fire shifts are. If you're on A shift and something happens to someone on C shift, it might take a while for you to learn about it and hear about it and know the extent of what's going on. And although there were people who knew what was happening, it wasn't their job to tell everybody else. It that wasn't on them. And that was something that even Andy had to tell them, like, this is not your burden. This is not something you need to worry about. Like, just thank you for being here for me. We appreciate it. But that was a simple email that could have been sent out. And then
I feel like the lack of communication between where I was and what I needed. It's real easy to get off the phone and say, hey man, anything you need, I'll be there. But I don't have the capacity mentally and physically to call all my friends every day. So I feel like the department as a whole did not communicate something that was so dramatic for our city and our fire department. I'm not saying just because I got hurt and me. I'm saying this is the first time anything like this has ever happened. You ask the city now. They've never went through a medical retirement like this. They've never went through workers' comp system like this. They have never seen a catastrophic injury like this. So I'm doing my part, man, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to every doctor's appointment. I'm messaging chiefs. I'm messaging the HR. Every time I leave a doctor's appointment, I'm giving update. I'm trying to keep them in the loop as much as possible. And I'm still having guys show up and ask me to shift swap for them. And so, you know, the feeling of that.
Before we return back to the interview, if you're feeling compelled to help individuals and heroes like Andy Allison, you can join us at Sons of the Flag in the campaign to help fund every firefighter in the United States that suffers a burn injury by taking the St. Florian vow. By taking the vow, you're committing to help every past, current, and future firefighter get the help that they need if and when they suffer a burn injury. By sharing a link out on social media and asking your friends and family to do the same. To do so, text the word JOIN, J-O-I-N, to the number 682-204-1729. Click on the link that is sent to you. Then, click on Create Florian Vow. Complete the requested information, and please, share it out. Or if you want to support Sons of the Flag, then you can go to sonsoftheflag.org and click the word donate. And if you or someone you know is in need of help, then email us at help@sonsoftheflag.org. Now back to our interview with Andy and Amanda Allison and Chad Gruber.
And I'm still having guys show up and ask me to shift swap for them. And so, you know, the feeling of that was just literally overwhelming for me because I felt like I was just lost in the process.
So you've lost your career.
Lost my career, yeah.
You've gone ahead and you know, we've retired at this point.
This is going into this retirement.
Going into retirement. And now you feel like you know, you're having to fight to find who you are, and now you feel like your department doesn't know what's going on.
That's right.
And you've lost your brothers.
I've lost them. Yeah. And not, again.
Not a person.
Not one person in this.
The second they find out, they're calling him. They're checking on him. They're
Everybody has their own family. And I mean, I don't want people at my, you know, at my door, knocking on the door every day, you know, trying to. I don't need people to leave their lives to come help me live mine. But like she said, man, there was a year I laid in that bed at home, and I can count on, you know, probably two hands the out of an apartment with 150 people, how many people showed up to just have a chat with me when I was lonely and I was lost in my own world. And, dude, they just didn't show up. And nobody, I mean, if there was a battalion chief that was solid on the shift, he'd send a crew, an engine over there. But on a one-on-one basis, you know, I didn't feel like I mattered to them and to the department. And it was a big realization for me, because that's what this is, right? That's what we do. We're the brotherhood that gets thrown away around all the time. I joke all the time that I do. There is a brotherhood. It just may not be where you think it's at. I mean, I've had people from other departments come in with overwhelming support and help. And you know what? Sometimes I don't need anything other than a text message saying, "Hey, dude, what's going on? How are you feeling? You've been busy at the doctor's." I mean, I don't need you to beat around the bush. I mean, we know I'm hurt. Sometimes I just want to hear somebody say, "Yeah, man, I hurt, my back hurt last week." You know, I'm also human, but everybody's always afraid to tell me about their problem, or, you know, "Hey, my toe hurts."
And they don't want to burden you.
They're like, "Oh, well, you know, your stuff's way worse than mine." And I'm like, "Yeah, but I'm also human, so I understand pain more than anybody." You stumped your toe and it hurts? Yeah, that does suck. I mean, you don't have it, not everything has to be compared to the severity of my injury, right? I just want to be a normal person that has normal conversations with my friends and my family, so I can figure out who I am and who I'm going to be, right? And that's all leading into this moment that is like, most people work their whole career for that retirement, right? They're waiting for that day. My dad's retirement, amazing. I mean, we put on the Class A's. We bring in the engines, you know, right? I mean, you just told me you're close to 20 years. And what are you working for? To retire one day, right? You love the job. But after you hit the 20 mark, you know, your focus is more on your family and on these other things. And you start looking at the fact of, "Hey, man, you know, I've done this, I've done well at it, but I kind of want to have my own. Every third day, I want to have that back," right? So a big moment in a fire career is the day that you retire. Well, dude, mine's in 10 years. Mine comes out of nowhere, not on my choice. And I'll say that group of people that I've talked about throughout this whole scenario, they put on one heck of a show, man. I mean, they brought everybody in. I mean, I got buddies that were new to the department that actually weren't even there, hired when I got hurt, that have been some of the biggest supporters. They just got into the career to do this, loved the job. Right after they got hired, they found out about my scenario. One of them in particular, I mean, he's still fighting to get me things. I mean, this wristband I'm wearing, he got it for me last week. He's out selling these things, trying to raise money to help me and Amanda with our battles with workers' comp. I mean, just a genuine guy. I mean,
you can plug his name.
I mean, Marcus Steele. I mean, he'll listen to it, I promise. I mean, that dude, I mean, there, you know, the Nick Pardas of the world, and, you know, all the chiefs that have stepped up and helped. I mean, I've met some of the best people in this industry, but I've also lost some of the people that I thought were the best the day that I got hurt, right? And so that's been tough. And that all goes into mental health, right? And the last thing I want to do is have my family processing all this and then me complaining to them about something else. So I'm complaining to them that I hurt and I can't get out of bed. And, "Hey, can you get me a drink? And, hey, can you get me the medicine? Oh, also, by the way,
You know, I hate my life, you know, at this moment. Like, that's the last thing you want to give them. And I think for me and for this PTSD push, like she said, I would go in for 1 hour and come out a changed person. And you know what? Half the time we didn't even talk about what I think was mental health. I went in there and complained about everything for an hour. Dropped a bunch of F-bombs, you know, played in their little sand thing over here. Ate some, she always had some, you know, snacks, had a snack, had a Coke. I mean, it was like 1 hour of the freaking straight bliss, dude. And nobody cried, right? When I would put that stuff on my family, man, they start crying. They're like, what's going on? He hates himself. He wants to die. I'm like, no, I'm just really pissed right now. So I go in there. I let it hang out. I come out, dude, I'm hopped up on sugar. I just played in a sandbox like I was a kid. Dude, this is like ultimate. So that was great, right? And you know, of course, workers' comp took that from me eventually. But so I go into the retirement, right? I mean, it was crazy.
It was good. It was. So he had his huge retirement ceremony, which meant tons to him and for us. And I know our kids are going to grow up and see those photos and know too. And I had a retirement party for him of sorts. I wouldn't say that it was really the normal retirement party atmosphere because it was really bittersweet. But those people that were there for him and checked in on him and even just phone calls and texts, you know, they were all there. And I remember two of them coming up to me saying how at the ceremony, there were people who had no idea he was that hurt. And I think that's part of it, is that he wants to share his story so that people can show, like, it's hard in our day and age. People just get on Facebook and they don't make that personal connection. It's just not there the same way. But when they know, then they know, like, shoot him a text message. He gets random texts from buddies he hasn't heard from in a year. And it's awesome. And it means so much to him.
And it is bittersweet with the retirement because
right,
there's no crossing now. It's, I mean,
no, it's over.
It's over.
I mean, whether I like it or not, whether I think I can overcome something, whether I think it doesn't matter what I think anymore.
I mean, right? Until that day happened, there was always a chance.
There was always the hope in me. Yeah. And I kept thinking coming up to that December deal, I don't care what these people say.
I'm going
to
find a way.
I'm going back to work, right?
Yeah.
Until the day that the last tones went off standing out in front of Central, you know? I have to watch, you know, my dad try to get up there and talk, and Chief McGrath and all these people that have been watching this process and, you know, and tears in their eyes. And, dude, it's like a day of mourning.
It wasn't the normal happy retirement.
It's not like a celebration of, hey, you did it. It was like, hey, we're glad you're here, you know?
We're glad you're alive.
We're glad you're alive, but you won't be coming here anymore scenario, right? It was literally, I felt extremely honored from my whole department. I mean, I had so many, you know, I had so much support. The production was amazing. But literally, it was the last day of something that I planned on doing for most of my life. So that it was tough. It was a tough day. Not my toughest day in all of this, I don't think. I mean, I've had some really tough decisions to make. But I think it was well thought out, well done, the best one I'd ever seen. I'm glad I was there to see my own. You know, I'm thankful for that. It was a celebration like a line of duty death, though. That's what I felt like. That's how big the production was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? See, you know, we're glad you're here, and then this is it. I won a ton of awards. I mean, they flew flags at the Capitol for me. I got Proclamation 8 put in the Senate. I mean, I had so many things done for us by our friends that the effort that was there and everybody's heart was in the right spot. I wasn't ready to do that.
And did that, Amanda, you know him better, did that throw you down a darker hole or did that make things worse?
Honestly, I think the darker hole came before that. Because he knew, once we knew it was coming, and then once that day happened, it was almost like he could breathe because didn't have a decision to make. It wasn't his decision. He had no choice. He had done absolutely everything he could do up to that point. He had fought workers' comp to get his surgeries, to get back, to be healed. He had worked with HR to figure out what's the best chance of me doing this, that, and the other. He had checked every box that he personally could have. He did everything he could to try to get back. And he just physically, he couldn't. And so I think after that day, it was bittersweet, but he could breathe knowing, like, okay, I can focus on me. I can focus on being healthy for my family and my future instead of having this countdown timeline of, I got to try to get better by this date. Otherwise, I'm done. Because unfortunately, that's how a lot of workers' comp in cities are. You only have this much time or else they're done. They're done trying. They're done holding your job for you and they're on to the next thing. So that was, I think, a very big stressful thing for him. So it let us in 2015 just kind of breathe and focus on getting him better and getting in a better spot as a family and as a couple and trying to figure out what our future was going to be like for us.
And almost comical. I mean, it's not because it was medical, but almost comical. Like, so I retired on the 31st of December. That was my official retire. But the retirement reception and party was until the 23rd, so the day after my birthday in January. And then 5 days later, I'm going to a hospital going to the doctor. We had to buy that. We bought this little Jetta so I could get back and forth. I mean, I'm driving to Dallas every day. I mean, so we had to get this little commuter. And it's a little standard car, and I'm driving it. Halfway down to the doctor, I go to shift gears and my right arm quits working. I mean, this is 5 days after the retirement reception. I call her. We had this awesome. So one of the guys, Billy McCorder, that works at the fire department, his wife works for Mattress Firm, right? And so they're trying to figure out how to help us. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, all these people, Billy didn't even hire in with me. I mean, these guys are just stepping up in just the craziest ways.
Big heart.
So they bring this huge deal, and they bring us this adjustable bed. They did the whole works, man. We got to go to Mattress Firm, lay on these things, checked. They had it closed down for us, man. This is the bed you need for your back. This thing was, I mean, you're talking about a Cadillac. I wouldn't pay this much for a car, the kind of things. I mean, these guys got white gloves on coming in there. I'm like, hey, have you ever been in my house? That white glove, it's not going to last long. I mean, I got kids running around in
our
here.
House is clean. Don't let him say otherwise.
I had two kids at this moment, right? There's Cheerios everywhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they come in. Like, I call her, I'm on the way back from the doctor, and I'm like, hey, I can't move my arm. And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, I can't move my arm. It's not working. And it's killing me. And she's like, well, can you drive? I'm like, yeah, well, I'm shifting with the other hand, so I'm coming home. And she goes, well, Mattress Firm, like, they're bringing in their president and all these, like, regional directors.
They had the managers and regional supervisors of this whole area come in, and they
Austin
brought this bed in and did it. It was incredible.
They brought their management team to put the bed together in there, right? Phenomenal. I mean, donated the whole thing, put me in their magazine. So here I come ripping up. Driving, I got my arm like tucked under this one, right? So it is held up. I can't move it. So I tuck it in and I'm out there shaking hands. And in the meantime, dude, I'm sweating. I'm hurting so bad. Like, my arm is in killer pain. So we do all the pictures. We hug everybody, meet everybody. They put the bed together. We do all this media show. And literally, they drive off and I tell her, take me to the hospital. And I'm not kidding you.
He's never, ever.
I'm never that way, first off. I hate the hospital.
There have been times where I've begged him to take him to the hospital. And he was like, no, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. It's fine. I'll call my doctor tomorrow. It was rough.
So I get to the hospital and they're like, oh, man, your neck is exploded. You need surgery tomorrow. And I'm like, seriously?
What number of surgery is this going to be?
This is the third back surgery. So this would be the fourth surgery.
And so, yeah, I mean, like, right after retirement, you know, I'm just got over this crazy. We're looking at 18 months for that one done in August, and now we're in February. And, like, that's what I'm saying, a year to the date, February 17th, in 15, I'm having
And the neck surgery, artificial disc.
He was, I mean, that the morning he had to go to the emergency room for his neck because his arm stopped working was the day we were supposed to have his retirement party with all of our family and friends. And we had to cancel it and postpone it for 2 weeks. I think we ended up doing it a month later.
We did.
And we just had it at Dave & Buster's, but they were so nice because they knew Andy's story, that they pushed it back and everything. But I had to call everybody and tell them, like, can't come to the party. We're going to the hospital. But thank you. It was
rough. So you ask about the process and me processing my retirement. Dude, there was, I mean, I haven't had time to process much. I mean,
I didn't realize that right after you retired, you went back into.
I mean, I've averaged, on average in 7 years, 2 major surgeries a year. And that's not including the 28 teeth that I broke. So, you know, I've had 40 mouth surgeries, probably a couple of $100,000 they've had to put in my mouth. I still, 7 years later, I still have 4 teeth that aren't completely fixed. I mean, I still have temporaries. I have all my teeth. I mean, last January, I joke that was, 2018, that I ate my first piece of corn on the cob in, 6 years. And people are like, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, have you ever gone 6 years without corn on the cob? It stinks. Because just the ability to do that, I mean, we're celebrating that kind of, those are the accomplishments now that we celebrate for me.
So with the neck surgery, I'm assuming it did a whole cycle of repeat. There was another, 4 weeks, 6 weeks of rehab, pain pills.
Still rehabbing from the other one, right?
Still rehabbing from the first
one. I'm doubling down.
Doubling down. And is Ruger here yet?
Not yet.
It's
getting close.
We're getting close to Ruger yet.
Getting close to Ruger.
Ruger's the second.
So day. Now we got, she's having, I mean, Ruger's a big dude. I mean, he's a massive kid.
He's going to be a linebacker, that's for sure. But so, at 15 weeks pregnant with him, I had to start wearing this belt for my hips because they were separating. So I wasn't able to walk without a belt. But he was in a wheelchair from his surgery, so I couldn't not walk or be on bed rest.
And they're like, so, who's supposed to pick Skylar up, right? I mean, so she's got this big belly, and I got the thing on here.
And you can't pick up a kid.
I look like a robot. I mean, if we looked like one heck of a couple, I can assure you, we walking into somewhere to go grocery shopping, I ain't got no teeth. She got this big old belly. I mean, it looks like I've just been all over this meth scenario. And
no one was taking pictures of us for any magazine.
That's right. We weren't the poster child for anything other than don't do this.
Y'all weren't sending out family Christmas cards every year.
That's so bad, dude. Yeah, if we did, it was awkward. One of those closed mouth smiles for me.
He jokes about it, but there was probably a good 2 years where he would not smile in front of anybody.
And yeah, that's hard, man. I mean, it's hard missing all your teeth.
Once again, this is just, even though you're not admitting it, this is beating you down mentally.
Well, yeah, it is. It's hard on me. And then, you know, I mean, we haven't been married that long, right? We were supposed to be in the honeymoon phase. And, you know, I mean, it's just, life did not turn out the way we planned it, right?
And y'all are planners.
And
I'm a planner. He's not a planner. He hates lists and planning schedules. Yeah. Not about it.
I'm sorry. That's what I mean.
Me. That's okay.
She is
that's
super.
We balance each other.
We balance each other. Yeah, it was. And then we, you know, that year, I mean, we're dealing with all kinds of other things, you know, just the transition of. It's hard for me to tell you exactly what that day of retirement did because I already hadn't worked in 2 years, right? I mean, I've been getting surgeries, so it's not like I'd been at the fire department. So I had a long position to realize, hey, well, it's not like that day, hey, you're riding the fire truck one day and you're never riding it again after that day. I already kind of had transitioned into more of a civilian life of being home every night. So a lot of those things were already worked out. It was just mentally me accepting that I wasn't going back. You know what I mean?
What happened with Lewis? Were you were medically retired? So
yes.
Do you still get a partial salary from them?
Man, I could go on 10 podcasts about how all this works. The simplest way I can give you an answer is yes, there is long-term disability. Most of the time, it's not tailored around first responders, right? So one of the issues that you run into is, like, for me, it's 60% of my salary, okay? Well, that 60% is not based on when I retired. It's based on when I got injured.
Okay.
So you go back to 2012 after I'd already got step raises and all the stuff you get, right? And it's based off a base salary, not paramedic and all these other things. So it's really like the lowest position
you get paid,
entry position, and then it's taxed. Okay, so it's nothing. I mean, it is a portion, okay, but then you think long-term disability, right? I'm getting that forever. Like, I'm going to get that until I die. So that's what all people think. But here's the stipulation that trips a lot of people up. Most cities pay you in Social Security, right? But a lot of fire departments don't,
no,
right? They don't pay into it. Well, most long-term disabilities are set up to give you disability until you reach the age of 65, and then you can go on Social Security. But the city of Louisville doesn't pay into Social Security.
They pay TMRS. Right?
They pay into TMRS.
And you didn't pay into TMRS long enough to have anything there, correct?
No, right? I was vested, but mm-hmm. I had no money in it. So when you, like, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here because there's just a lot of different things you can explain. But basically, if you didn't work, if you don't have enough quarters in some kind of part-time job where you get Social Security, then at 65, you get only what your TMRS was at the year. So I get $400 a month from TMRS, right? And at 65, I will not get anything else. Okay, so is it long-term disability? Is it a benefit? I mean, people are always like, well, yeah, you got a long-term disability. I'm like, yeah, it's not that very long-term. You know, I'm 36, and I plan on living past 65. So now I have to, what am I, at 65, I'm be so crippled. So now what am I going to do, right? I mean, those are the things that I'm trying to educate people on is, hey, we need to take a look at what we're offering and what you're getting that day you sign up to be a first responder, right? Because they don't like separating civilians and first responders when it comes to, you know, different kind of insurances, because as a civilian working for the city, then you think you're getting unfairly treated because these guys get all the gold stuff and they get the better, okay? So cities don't like to do that because they don't want to discriminate against a classification of a job. Understandable, except for my job, there's a good chance you could die, you know? I mean, so there is a separation in that category, and I don't think at this point we've done a good enough job of explaining to people why first responders need that kind of help. Because I think civilians, the assumption is they won't understand, but I think civilians think we are getting treated that way. The community that's paying into those taxes to help first responders and to give them those fire trucks and to bond elections, they think that when you get hurt, you get hurt, you get hurt, you're taken care of. But that's not the case right now. So, I mean, it has been a tremendous battle for us, and it's still not over. I mean, I'm right in the middle of fighting for benefits. And that's... that's hard on top of the injury. Is now, I want to feel like when we got married, I wanted to feel like I'm sure everybody does. I'm going to provide for you. You can be a stay-at-home mom. We'll reach this point. We want kids. We want that. I want you to live your life how you want to live it. And I'm going to be the husband that provides whatever for you. And now I've stared down the road for 7 years of being the husband that can't provide anything because I can't hardly provide for myself. So there's a lot of things that work against me mentally, but you know, we've done a good job of, I try to be vocal with her on how I feel with that. And she's awesome. I mean, people don't understand how we've lived on such little money for the last couple of years. And, you know, we value our time together and our kids, and you know, we don't put a whole lot of thought into possessions other than we buy what we have to buy to get by. And Eventually, hopefully, we'll be in a situation where we won't have to be. But right now, we just need to hunker down and do what we have to do, right? So it's crazy.
Amanda?
Yes. You know, he's talking about us hunkering down, doing what we got to do. And financially, yes, that's kind of how we've approached it. But I think that's also how we've approached our day-to-day life. So a lot of people always ask us, like, how do y'all get through this? How do you get through everything he has gone through and experienced and carried? And how do we raise our kids through it? And that's just what we do. We hunker down. And sometimes it's not the best answer to just do it and push through it and slap a smile on your face. But we always go back to keeping our communication, both mostly between me and Andy, but also as a family, is the most important thing. Because if we're happy and we have a home where our kids are loved and safe and smiling, then we'll take it one day at a time.
Well, there's not a lot of communication with the boys at this point yet.
You'd be surprised. They're pretty
smart.
I
meant like at the time, 2015.
Oh,
yeah,
no,
yeah, not so much.
They can't understand. I mean, when you raise them knowing that I can't pick them up, then they already don't know any different. They don't know any different. So that's one thing that was really hard at first for me to think. But as we went, you know, when they were a baby, I can hold them. I mean, but once they are walking and big enough, I can't, I'm not supposed to pick up more than 10 pounds, right? Unless, from my doctor, unless it's your babies, and make your own choices. But realize when you're picking your babies up, the heavier they get, the shorter span you have later in your life of staying away from help walking. So she understands that to make our family work, sometimes I have to pick up Ruger to get him in a shopping cart at Walmart, because that's what people don't think of. It's not just picking up my kid to play with him. It's like, if I go somewhere on my own with my kids, how do I get him in and out of the car if you can't pick him up? So you may see me pick my kid up. Am I supposed to? No, but I also have to function in life, right? So I have to make those sacrifices, and we just try to do it in a strategic way to say, what kind of day are you having? Are you feeling good? Are you feeling okay? And I'm like, yeah, I feel good enough to, okay, I'll take the kids and do this and you do whatever. And some days I just tell her, I'm like, hey, you know, I can't do it today.
Well, and Ruger has experienced Andy going through surgeries, but right now we're talking about like 2015. And those were the big ones. Ruger never experienced those, but Skylar did. And after Andy's big one in 2014, I mean, even when Andy was home, like, Skylar did not want to go to him. He wanted to see him. He wanted to go sit there next to him.
He kept a big distance.
But he did not want to go near Daddy, because Daddy was in a bed hooked up to all this stuff, and he looked hurt. And then even he looked sick. And even after 2015, when he got hit, like, you know, in his neck, that done, you know, Skylar would go up there and sit with him and watch TV with him and not move. And I don't know any 2-year-old that'll just sit there, and because he wanted to be with his dad, he wanted to spend time with him, but he knew I can't move, I can't rough play with him, I can't tick, like, and that's kind of hard, because, you know, Andy wants him to experience that. Everyone wants their kid to do that, and so it's been difficult, but that's all they know, and they've been so good about it. They do ask Andy when his scratches are going to heal up, though.
Yeah.
They don't understand the concept of scars yet.
Yeah.
So they'll be like, oh, Dad, your scratch is bothering you. Is it hurting?
Yeah, now they're. And we try to give them a certain level of protection away from some of those things, you know. We give them enough now. I mean, if you're looking at it today, they're old enough to process a lot of heavier things. But that doesn't mean they can. They know what it means, but when they see it with me, it's really hard. So, when I had surgery the last couple of times, you know, I don't like them to come to the hospital. I have a hard time with letting my kids see me down, because I want them to be overcomers. But there's a certain level of, they get to see me around the house, you know, hurting and trying to overcome things, but I don't want them to have a picture of me in the hospital all the time. So, you know, it literally has been a crash course in for us and how to have a family when your life is at the craziest moment. Well, I mean, that's what we're doing.
And thank goodness for family, because summer 2015, I was big as a whale pregnant with Ruger, and we thought it would be a perfect idea to go visit Andy's parents in Florida for a mini vacation, get our mind off of everything.
Of course,
you know.
Why not?
Cool. So we go, and we decide to go spend a day at Disney. So Andy's in a wheelchair. We're with his parents.
Yeah,
I'm
genius.
Mega prego. And then here's Skylar just eating it up, loving it. And they come out and do their little dancing show with Mickey and Minnie and Peter Pan and everybody. And well, all these kids are on their dad's shoulders. And our 2.5-year-old, that's what he wants to do. But daddy can't do that. And I'm super pregnant. So I'm sitting here like strategically like, okay, if I put him here, then I can, because I can't bend over to pick him up, to put him on my shoulders. And thank goodness for my father-in-law, because he just picked him up, put him on his shoulders, carried him around all day long. But it's the little things that a lot of people don't think about, that, you know, your 2-year-old wants to be on your shoulders like everybody else so he can see Mickey Mouse, and you can't do it. Like, what do you do?
That's tough. It's tough for me in those situations, you know. I mean, the normal day stuff, I've kind of figured out with them how to adjust and make things happen. But it is when because I'm jealous too. I see dads that are, you know, winging their kids around and carrying them and make sure they can see over the crowd. And I know that that's not something that's going to be possible. And that's just, I mean, I remember doing that with my dad. I freaking loved that. You know, my dad picking me up and, you know, doing all kinds of stuff, throwing me in the swimming pool and doing all kinds of things. And I know that I can't do that with them. So I really focus hard on trying to make it up to them in a different way, you know, and be a different dad than my dad was. I mean, my dad was the greatest dad ever to me. I mean, he was amazing. But I can't be that kind of dad because I don't have the physical body to do that anymore. So we've had to pave our own way on how to be parents and be successful at being parents. And, you know, I don't know what the definition of successful parents are. So I'm not going to say we're there, because that's a pretty tough one to.
You're successful. They're living.
They are healthy, right? And they get along most of the time. So I will tell you, I know she hit back on this earlier, you know, us getting, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of this, but like when people come to visit me, there's a lot of emotion in me that I don't give to a lot of people except for her, right? Even my parents tell me that I'm different because I don't give them the emotion, but I have a hard time doing that now because there's a lot of emotional things for me. So anyways, she brings up this earlier that when people would come visit, literally, we would go get me on the couch. And the reason we would do that is because when I would go from standing to sitting, I would cry. Like, literally, it hurts so bad that I would cry. And sometimes it's not like I got, you know, I'm boohooing, but I mean, I got tears rolling down my eyes because I'm trying to tough it out and I can't. So we would get me situated because, I mean, even my brother came over and saw me one time, and he had to help me get in the chair because she wasn't there. He came to babysit. And he left there and told my mom, he said, I can't go back. I love him, but I can't see him like that. I can't do it because it's too tough on me, because I've never seen him in pain and not be able to do it. So this last year, I had a really bad thing on my back, and I had to call my dad and ask him to take me to the hospital. Or not to the hospital, went to the doctor. Same kind of scenario. So I called him and I said, hey, I need you to come do something. And I try not to ask many people outside of me and her, because I don't like people seeing me that way. And I don't like them to have to go home and grieve over it, because I know they do. They think that that's probably unfair and that I'm, you know, trying to keep all my stuff private. But really, it's because I know me and her are equipped to deal with what we got going on. But my parents that don't get to see me much, I want them to see me when we're happy and having fun. And so I call my dad, and on the way over there, I'm trying to prepare him. I'm like, hey, man, when you get me out of this car, I'm going to cry. and I'm going to be really hurt, Dad. And he's like, okay, okay, okay. And I'm like, I just want you to be ready, Dad. And we get there, and he gets me out, and I'm in full-blown tears, and he, you know, gets under me and gets me up, and I see this look on his face, and it literally broke my heart. And I, you know, talked to whatever, and he tells somebody, I don't remember who it was, that was almost one of the hardest moments of his life, is watch his son try to get out of that car. And I knew that. I knew that, and that's why a lot of things are so private with me, because I don't want people leaving there, and now he's got to go deal with watching his own son have to do that. It's just, it's too hard for me to put people in that position.
I can't imagine. So one of the great things that I know you're very private, and one of the things that you did, you got to teach at FDIC.
Yeah.
In 2016. Or it was 2016 was you're preparing for it. Yeah, while overcoming this. Did you use that to, I mean, it was, unfortunately, I didn't get to go to the class, but tell us about that experience.
You know, I always go back to Chief McGrath pushing me into this teaching thing. It's been an awesome experience. Literally, it does help me. You know, I think that the story is one thing, but what we can learn is a total different thing, because it's not like a hard concept to learn. We need to look at benefits. Okay. Yeah. No doubt. We also need to look at different dangers than getting hit on the highway and falling through roofs. I mean, the fire service and police service do not pay enough attention to electricity. I mean, I'm sorry, but our whole world is ran by electricity right now. We have high rises that have battery stations in them. I haven't done any electrical emergency stuff in my history of the fire service. Now they're doing that. And so bringing that awareness, it stinks that I had to go through this. And if I could take it back, I wouldn't heartbeat, I'd get on that fire truck. But I have had an awesome opportunity to get to go out there and influence people and hopefully keep somebody in their department from being an Andy Allison, right? So going to FDIC was a crazy process. So hard to get in. You know, you got like 3,000 applicants for, you know, a couple hundred classes. I had Chief Lasky obviously help me a lot prepare for that. And, you know, video submissions, all these things. I've never been a teacher. So, and they're so structured on getting into that thing. You know, teaching for an hour and 45 minutes was, it's hard for me to prepare for that. All I've ever done is like a bunch of banquet, like keynote speakers. But in that class, I had, I don't know, 50 people, right? And out of that have come some of the most amazing friendships and people that have jumped on board and helping my battle, not physical battle, but battle against what we're up against with workers' comp and the vision on first responders and teaching first responders about not really being invincible like they think they are. I mean, I out of that came amazing relationships. One with Sons of the Flag. I met y'all there. I mean, look at all the things that we were able to do and hopefully we're going to do in the future. I mean, right now, I mean, with this three-part series, I mean, it's just going to be phenomenal because it's kind of off the cuffs for me. I get to come in here and say what I want. Everything else, like FDIC, is so scripted for me to do. I want an opportunity to go back because I'm a little bit healthier now. You know, I was still really, really struggling with some of my surgeries at that point. And it was a huge deal to get me all the way up there. Oh my gosh, the whole thing was hard. And I went by myself. She's here with the kids. And I mean, she's my infrastructure, right? And so there was a lot of things that I didn't know that I needed guidance on from people that had been there. Like they put me out by the airport. So I had to like bus and Uber in every day to go teach, which if I would have known that, I would have just spent the money to be right across the street because I'm crippled. I mean, let's face it. I can't walk miles every day. So that was, there's a big learning curve at FDIC, but I feel like the message was great. I feel like I probably didn't title it the best because I'm sorry. Firemen, policemen, any kind of first responders and wives, they don't want to go to a class about hearing about mental health. They don't want to hear about any kind of health. They want to go learn how to be a rock star firefighter, right? They want to go to these classes about kicking doors in. They don't want to go learn about risk management and how not to die and what that means in a sad story, even though when they come in there, they're freaking mind blown when they hear the process and what's going on. So getting them in the door is the problem. The message has been really taken well. But that experience was wild. And I was very honored because not many people get to go up there and teach.
Well, and I think for Andy, I saw a big change for him around that same time. So he was doing a lot of banquets, being keynote speakers, and then FDIC, it gave him a purpose again and something to focus on. And that was kind of at the beginning of the different therapy training they were helping him overcome, because I know we mentioned in the first one that he has some brain damage too, and that's, it's difficult for him to do the same one task for a while. So it let him reach a goal to be able to stand up there and teach this long class and do it. And that was huge, huge.
Yeah. And it puts you back in the fire service. That's right. I'm teaching my people, right? Like the people that I've grew. I mean, it's not just that I did 10 years in the fire service, everybody. I mean, I grew up in the fire service. My dad's, you know, would be probably close to 40 years in the fire service.
Your legacy.
I mean, my brothers are firemen. I mean, that's all that we're surrounded by. Her parents are doctors. My mom's a nurse. I mean, this is our life. So there's no way to get out of it. So me being able to stay relevant in it has been awesome. And I've got a couple of gigs I've done. I went to Missouri and taught their winter fire school, and they treated me awesome. And I do enjoy that. I think that one of the things that I need is, I need an ending to the story, right? And we're just not there yet. I got a couple more surgeries I need. We may never be through with surgeries, but I need like a spot to say, you know, we did 7 years of me battling, and then we hit this mark where we finally had some answers, and I had a clear path of I need 5 more surgeries and this rehab, and this is who Andy Allison is now. Like, I need that defining moment. And I'm just not there, you know. I had an implant put in 6 weeks ago in my back. And so, I mean, 50 inches of scars is what I have. I mean, so when you think about all these things, when they're cutting all over you, and I'm different than I was 7 years ago. But every year I become a different person. I become more rigid on things. I become a different father, a different husband. We both have grown through the 7 years, and I'm excited to get to the point where I can say, here we are.
You know, right? And, you know, I think Amanda, you said it, you take it one day at a time.
You have to.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Sure.
When people a lot of time look at us and they'll make comments and say, like, you guys are so happy, you're so carefree, and it's crazy because I feel like who we were before this and who we are now, we've grown a lot. And the things that we can just be, what's the word I'm looking for? Carefree, go lucky, like go with the flow, like we are. Because a lot of things in our lives, we can't. We're told when to be and where to be for Andy's medical stuff. We have to fight workers' comp because 2 times now his adjuster has left and we've had no one to talk to when he's in the middle of about to have a surgery, and then all of a sudden they don't have anyone for his care, so there's no one for him to even talk to say, can I go? When am I getting scheduled? What am I doing? Like, this is crazy stuff. It's out of your control, and it's very stressful, and it can beat you down. So when you can, just go with it. You got to.
I mean, that's, we joke all the time. I have no control over my life out the threshold of my front door. I mean, more now. I mean, it is getting better, but when I worked for Louisville, I'm literally working for the fire department that I don't go to work to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm still their employee, so I'm still having to do the check-ins. I'm still having to message them. I'm still living under their rules, right? and they expect me to do these things. I mean, this, we have something coming up on the 27th. I had to sign initial this piece of paper, and it said, you will be here on the 27th. There is no question. You mandatory have to be at this meeting. Well, I mean, there you go. There's my life in a nutshell in this system. Is they tell me where to go, and I guarantee you, I miss an appointment, they're calling me. Why did you miss this appointment? Your job is to get better and to go to these appointments that we make for you. And if you don't go to them, then we will have to say, you know, we may not send you anymore kind of scenario. So, I mean, we run our life. Number one thing in our life for me and her is family health. We want our kids to be healthy. My job is to be as healthy as I can be. That's what we've decided. She supports that. I support her dreams. She has got an amazing career in what she's done and what she's been able to do with since I got injured. And I support her on that end. But when I need something done for me, it's my job to take that over, call the doctors, call workers' comp, call the city, fight for what I need. And I tell her, hey, I got a crazy week of trying to get my stuff situated. And she'll say, hey, what do you need? And I'll, you know, whatever it is, she's there. But we each have our own jobs now. And my job just happens to be trying to be healthy.
You know, one of the things, and I've told you since then, but I remember, you know, being a Dallas firefighter in the Metroplex, I'd always heard the Andy Allison story. I had never met Andy Allison. We all know it's out there.
Yeah.
And I remember being at the Pierce party. Mm-hmm. And in Indianapolis. And Bird Landon was there. Birdman was there. And I remember you sitting down at the table. And I didn't know you were even teaching. Really feel bad about that now.
It was all in the title.
You know, Andy, I have to truly believe that if you went back to FDIC, it would be a little bit different result this time. You know,
I'm more known.
It'd be a little bit different result. And I remember looking at Bird and talking. I go, hey, that's Andy Allison. And he goes, yes, sir. And I go, he got electrocuted. That's a burn. And I go, I don't know. And I hadn't been with Sons that long.
Yeah.
I just took over Texas, yeah. And I was running it as a task force leader. And I said, if there is anybody that we need to help, that I want to help, I want to help Andy. And Bird said, okay, find a way to do it. And came and supported me. And actually, I remember right after we had that discussion, Bird and I walked over to your table and introduced ourselves.
Yeah, we talked for a little while that night. That was a good night. Yeah, and man, I was telling Bird the other day, we spoke for like a couple of hours the other day on the phone, which was nice. Just sometimes it's nice to talk to somebody that's lived in a tough scenario and been through what he's been through. You know, I don't understand the military stuff like he does, but hardship and tough decisions he does understand. So we talked about a lot of different mental stuff and what he's gone through and what I'm going through. And, you know, something I told him is there's not a whole lot of people in life that are really true to their word outside of their personal beliefs. But when you're talking about companies and foundations, how they operate and what their main goal is, and I've been very skeptical. Both of us have. I've had a lot of people approach me and her to try to use my story and my things to promote something that they need. On the other end, it's going to help me. But that's something that I just respect what y'all do so much and your organization, because I'm the one that's offered to go speak at y'all's things. I've never been asked to do anything. I try to involve myself because I love what y'all do. I love y'all guys so much. I mean, y'all are just an awesome group. Bird's awesome. Y'all stepped up. You know what? You told me you were going to find a way to help me. And, you know, it was a couple of years later and here we are, and y'all have done a lot, but there was a planning process, but you did what you said, and my hat's off because that usually doesn't happen. And y'all have been true to us And that's all I'm looking for, man. And the raffle that we've done and some of the things we'll get into on this, on part three, are just literally life-changing for me and Amanda. But moreover, it's the friendships, I think, that we've built up here. You know, we don't get to hang out all the time, but y'all have been awesome supporters for everything we've needed.
I'll tell you what, and I don't know if y'all have heard this before. I think I said it. What y'all's next step needs to be is writing a book on communication.
Tell him that. I have been telling him for... Okay, given I did start telling him this before, he probably was mentally prepared for it. Yes.
Because... And I will throw myself under the bus. I'm a terrible communicator. My wife will tell you that.
It's hard.
Y'all are a inspiration to marriages, not only fire department marriages, but how y'all have overcome this.
It's incredible.
Every story needs an ending, though. Like I'm keep telling her, like, I'm with you. We need a book, but we need to get to, like, I mean, Andy Allison's still getting surgeries every 3 months. I mean, we got to have like a long enough break for us to like have some kind of ending.
It can be a series. Just think of it that way. Write a book.
Series.
Do a like book now.
Now you're writing Harry Potter.
And then write another one when you get the ending. Yeah. There you go.
I can't wait. They sound amazing. They do sound good, actually.
We can give our grilled cheese analogy.
That's right.
That would be great.
Sons of the Flag was founded in 2012 by Ryan Birdman Parrott. We are a nonprofit organization committed to supporting military, first responders, and their families through a burn injury by providing funding for innovative research. We bring together passionate community leaders, pioneering physicians, experienced military service members, dedicated first responders, and purposeful civilians to complete our mission. Here at Sons of the Flag, we have several programs that we are involved in: Mission Reconstruct Freedom, medical fellowships, and providing burn aid and equipment to the local burn centers. Mission Reconstruct Freedom is identifying the surviving burn veteran or first responder in need of reconstruction. Via Skype will be used to allow the reconstructive surgeons to evaluate and record reconstructive needs and plan the procedures required to improve the patient. The patient will be transported to Tampa, undergo the necessary procedures, and receive mental support as necessary. Once the care is completed, the survivor will join a registry so future needs will be recognized and addressed. The Medical Fellowship Program plays a vital role in helping medical institutions educate the next generation of physicians, researchers, and healthcare professionals, while also enhancing the medical center's ability to recruit some of the most brilliant minds in medicine. Additionally, Sons of the Flag receives requests from burn units across the country to pay for various needs within the burn unit, including equipment. Each request is fully vetted and consideration is given for funding. Head over to Facebook to see a list of our upcoming events and for future events. Some of the upcoming events are the Sons of the Flag Sporting Clay Shoot, Saturday, June 15th, beginning at 9 a.m. in Henderson, Maryland at Schrader's Outdoors. Also, Saturday, June 15th, we have Tactics on Tap with Benny Clark at the City Tavern in Salisbury, North Carolina at 7:30. Additionally, Sons of the Flag will be beneficiaries to various upcoming events, like the Oath Keepers Fire Conference going down September 27th through the 29th in Milan, Ohio, with a very special thank you to Kyle Romagis for arranging this to happen. Also, Sons of the Flag will be the beneficiaries of the FD Training Tactics Faith Family Fire Conference happening on November 18th through the 20th at the Gaylord Texan Resort in Grapevine, Texas. You can find all these events, others like it, on the Facebook pages of Sons of the Flag. And be sure to check us out on all social media at Sons of the Flag. We again would like to thank Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio for allowing this podcast to air. Stay safe, stay passionate. Until next time, never lose faith in the overall mission.